My name is Russell Statz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the South Dixie Group. I haven't found necessarily have a drink, nor have I, since January 25th, 1981. It's a great privilege to be here with you guys, and I want to welcome a few people. First of all, I see a lot of my friends, hi guys, on Zoom. This is a hybrid meeting. I love these things. It says, God will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but for the last year and a half, or something like that, I've been going to about three or four, five Zoom meetings a day. And I have all these great friends and people that I've met who I love and care about from all over the world. And people here from, I see Francis from Australia. Annie, I think you're up in Washington, D.C. And Cindy, Jersey Shore, and all of the United States. Yvonne, I'm praying for Steve. We're all praying for Steve. God bless you, sweetheart. We're all talking about you and praying for you today at Lester's. We miss you guys and so many people, Trini and Andrea. And if I leave you out, don't get upset with me. It's nice. And all these people. And I want to especially welcome new people. It takes a lot of guts. Well, it takes a lot of guts, so you got to be desperate. Either way, you know, to come to an AA meeting, walk in here, and I think I want to congratulate people that are coming back and things like that. And I see Morris in the audience. I'm congratulating you on your 23 years. I know 20 years recovery. That's fantastic. And it's just wonderful to be here with you guys. And I'm going to share a little. Now, there's this vicious rumor going around that there's a possibility that I might actually talk about a step tonight. Now, let me tell you something. Don't get ahead of me. I'm not making any promises. You know, I mean, I may have had an intention to talk about a step. I mean, this is a step series. I think on Rocketed, this is talk number 10. And we're on the ninth step. I'm not sure how that happened. Actually, I didn't know how that happened. I came here one birthday night or something, and I had like 15 minutes to share something, so I did like an introduction to step four or something. And so we're presumably on step nine tonight. And I woke up this morning, I just had this feeling, you know, I said, you know, I think I might actually talk about a step tonight. You know, I know you might find this hard to believe. I've been actually talking about all the steps at every meeting. Have you caught that? I haven't figured that out yet. I had a gentleman today at Lester's start telling me about the, we were talking about this deal. You know, a lot of you guys have been here for a while, so you might know, when I say chicken on the roof, you might know what I'm referring to if you've ever heard the chicken on the roof story, which is a true story. The truth of the matter is that there's 110 people in the room tonight. There's, no matter what I'm saying, there's probably 110 stories going. There's 100, whatever you're hearing, I've been to enough meetings that I know, first of all, I can somehow have some control, not much, over what I say. I have no control over what you hear. You could hear what I say. You could hear what the Lord wants you to hear. You could hear all sorts of things. And I've been to enough meetings to know that people will walk up to you and say, you could speak for hours, and I really loved it when you said this. Or you said that, you know, half the time they get it right, but it wasn't matter. It doesn't matter. That's what they heard. You know what I mean? And so this gentleman today, what came up and says, you know, I really like the Leo story. He didn't remember the Leo. He said the story of the guy who walked 5 miles to get to your house so he'd go to a Bible study. So I said, you mean the Leo story? He said, yeah, the Leo story. I really love that story. And I said to him, I said, well, let me ask you something. I said, that story that you love, that really impressed you, the kid that I spoke to at the laundromat, and who I told him if he showed up at my house at 7:30, I'd take him to a Bible study, the 16-year-old kid. And that story about when I woke up that morning, he was out by my car, and he came to the Bible study with me, and that's an AA story, believe it or not. It doesn't have anything to do with alcoholism. It has to do with loving other people and carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to other people, which doesn't necessarily have anything to do with alcohol. The alcohol is a symptom of our disease. Our disease centers in our mind. It's about how we think about ourselves and how we care about other people, or whether we care about other people at all, or whether we're selfish. And And how he went to Bible study, and then I drove him back, and I found out that he had woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I asked him how he got to my house. He said he woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and walked 5 or 6 miles to my house because he didn't want to miss me. That's how badly he wanted to go to the Bible study. He was a 16-year-old kid, no father, single mother, little 3-year-old daughter, and a 3-year-old sister. And just a young kid trying to figure out his way in life and what the hell's going on. And we saw a Bible in my car. I have in my car Bibles, big books, 12 and 12s all over the place. And he said, I got one of those. And I said, you mean a Bible? He says, yeah. I said, you ever go to a Bible study? He says, no. I said, you're at my house at 7:30 tomorrow morning. I'll take you to a Bible study, men's Bible study. And he showed up at my house. And I didn't realize he had walked. He'd woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning and walked, 5 or 6 miles to the Bible study. So I took him there, and then I drove him back to his house. And so tonight, it's a story I tell. It's just a story about, because if you're in this fellowship and you love God, and like Bill Wilson said, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I have to keep talking about it and telling other people. When you're grateful for the miracle that the Lord has done in your life, and you have to tell other people about it. Listen, you just don't restrict yourself to people that have a medallion in their pocket. I just don't love people that have a medallion. You don't have to have a medallion in your pocket for me to love you. You don't have to be a recovering alcoholic for me to love you. You don't have to be an alcoholic that's not in recovery for me to love you. I can even show love and affection and try to help 16-year-old kids that are fatherless. Because that's what God wants me to give you, to be a maximum service to others. Not only alcoholics. Now, it so happens he planted me here. So this is sort of like my ministry. I don't leave this place. Because this is where he planted me here. Because this is where I'm most effective. But I can be effective with people who aren't alcoholics. What we suffer from is basically common to most people. The fears we suffer from, the anxiety we suffer from. We think it's like us and earth people. You know what I mean? Earth people suffer from the same stuff. They suffer from. They just don't have any meetings to go to. It's even worse for them because they can suffer from this stuff until the day they die and never find a way out. Because the suffering is great, but you want to know something, they never get to the point where they have the disease we have, where they start losing jobs over them, or something. The consequences are so bad that they have to do something to get out of their suffering. They just live lives of quiet desperation, as Henry Thoreau said. But us, on the other hand, we're the fortunate ones. Because in our suffering, what we do is we drink or we drug. And eventually we die or kill somebody or hurt somebody or it gets so bad where we're forced to either accept something like this and come in here or die or live life, a miserable life. We take it to the bitter end, as they say in the book. We have no choice. We have a choice, but we really have no choice. It's either life or death. It's a life or death thing for us. So I told this story, the Leo story, and I said to him, and I don't know what it is. He really, and I noticed this throughout the last 40 years I've been sober. I mean, I've been told that story for, I don't know, over 30 years now. And I noticed that that's something he paid attention to. It meant something to him. I said it during one of these meetings. I don't know when I said it on the fifth step or the sixth, whatever the hell it was. So I said to him this. I said, what step do you think that was about? I said, what step do you think that was about? You think that was about when that kid got up at 3:30 in the morning? There's a step before the step. It says, if you want what we have and you're willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. I said, what step do you think that was about? Do you think it was about the first step? Do you think that step was about the step before the steps that says, if you want what we have and you won't go to any length to get it, then you'll go to any length to get it? Do you think it's about the third step? When that kid got up in the morning to go over to that Bible study and meet, you think it was about the third step? You think it was about the sixth step? The step where you make such commitment to God and to do this thing that you're willing to go all out and do it. You think it was about the sixth step, or the seventh step? Maybe it was about the 11th step. Think it was about the 11th step. Maybe think it was about the 12th step. You know, you think that was about 12th step work? What do you think that was? Well, I guess it's whatever. It's not the world. You don't see the world the way it is. You see the world the way you are. I suppose if in your heart, whether you know it or not, you're looking for somebody to talk to you about the third step, I guess it's the third step story for you. And if you're looking for somebody to talk to you about the 12th step, I guess it's a 12th step story for you. I'll bet if I told that story to 110 people or something like that, there'd be some people that ain't looking for anything and they're not going to get anything from it. They won't even remember it. There'll be other people like this young man I spoke to, and he's looking for something, and that story just excites him. He remembers it from 2 months ago. He remembers that story. He'll probably never forget that story. He may forget that it was Leo, but he remembers some story about some kid who walked 7 miles, a 16-year-old kid, and had nothing to do with alcoholism, but it had something to do with his alcoholism. And so what I guess I'm trying to say is if you're an alcoholic, this is a program of adopting a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. It's a way of life. You know, if you're an active alcoholic, I was an active alcoholic. If you're an active alcoholic, it means more than just drinking. It means adopting a way of life that demands dishonesty. It means adopting a way of life where you're always feeling sorry for yourself. It means adopting a way of life where you're always blaming other people for your problems. It means adopting a way of life where you walk around saying, I can't believe this is happening to me again. It means adopting a way of life where you're always saying, I'll show them, or they don't know who I'm screwing it. Who the hell do they think I am? I ain't never gonna. It means adopting a way of arrogant, defiant life that is self-destructive. Carl Menninger said, alcoholics are men and women who have to destroy themselves. It's more than the drinking. The drinking is a symptom. It has to do with a way of life, you know? And if you're a recovering alcoholic, it means adopting a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. It means adopting a way of life which demands that, as they say in chapter of the agnostic, what do they say? They said the idea of being an agnostic or an alcoholic or an atheist must be abandoned. It means adopting a way of life where you have to make a decision. God is either everything or nothing. What is your decision going to be? It means adopting a way of life where you're on a spiritual basis. It means a whole lot. It means so much more than drinking or not drinking. As a matter of fact, the way of life we have has nothing to do with the drinking thing. You know what? You know what they say in the fourth? They say we are 100 alcoholics who have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. You know what a hopeless state of mind and body is? It's not even feeling sorry for yourself. It's not even being self. A hopeless state of mind and body is when you wake up in the morning and say, I'm not going to drink today, and by 4 o'clock, you're drunk. Hopeless state of mind and body is saying, I'm not going to go to the bar today, and mean it, and by 4 o'clock, you're searching for dimes, nickels, and quarters, so you can go down to Winn-Dixie and get a $2.89 bottle of Chianti and sit by the record player and drink yourself unconscious. It means a hopeless state of mind is when you can't stop drinking. Is when you can't. I have recovered. You have recovered, whether you know it or not, from a hopeless state of mind. We're recovered alcohol. Let me tell you something. How many people came here because they couldn't stop drinking and drugging? Raise your hand. How many people have stopped? I don't care if it's for 10 days. You've recovered. Maybe you don't remember. Let me remind you, because you might have forgotten. You came into AA because you couldn't stop drinking. How's it working for you? You don't want your money. You're not demanding your money back, are you? But now you know you're insane. Now you know you're crazy. You're a little crazy. You understand? I understand that. You know, you've been told, and maybe you even believe, and it's true, that God will restore you to sanity. They just didn't tell you how long it was going to take. I know when you're drinking scotch, you understand what I'm saying? You go in there, you know, if you drank like I did, and that is fast. I was a fast drinker because I believe me, I want to be rocking in the fourth dimension immediately, you know? I always drank for the noble art of getting bombed, you know? Other people will say, I'm feeling it. I said, that's the whole point, you know what I mean? I just whack, 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 you know what I mean? And that's the great thing about scotch. Or whatever it is you're drinking, because it gets you to the point where you really don't give a crap what other people think about you. And it happens quickly. This AA is not like that. You may spend the first 10 years with people in your brain. You may spend the next 10 years lathering up in the shower, sober, working in Alcoholics Anonymous, saying to yourself, I'm a piece of shit, I ought to kill myself. I mean, if you're an alcoholic, let me tell you something. Some guy said, I think you have a split personality. I said, I wish I could get it down to two. I'd be okay. You know? Yeah. You're an alcoholic. You fluctuate between, I'm the greatest guy in the world. I am smarter than anybody. I'm better than anybody. And I'm a piece of shit. I ought to kill myself. You know what I mean? And when you got those two thoughts, and you know something? Sometimes you hold them both in your brain at the same time. And when you have that going for yourself, when you think you're incredible, and you don't give a shit about anybody, and you don't care what they think about you. And on the other hand, all you're thinking about is, what are they thinking about me? Why did I do that? I can't believe I said that. I'm going to kill myself. I'll never be okay. When you got that stuff going for you in your brain, and you're always having a conversation with only one person, the only person you ever talk to is, you know who it is, you. And that person is sick. And you have to do that sober. Sober in this world, which has a lot of moving parts in it and crazy people that are mostly discernibly wrong, you might come to the conclusion, even after you stop drinking, that there's something more wrong. There's something wrong with you that has nothing to do with scotch. And that doesn't necessarily go away because you go to one or two meetings, or three or four meetings, or after 5 or 10 years. For 15 years. I mean, that's sort of like, that's the thing you like plug at. Repeated humiliations. Final crushing of your self-sufficiency. That's something that goes on and on. And you're working these steps over and over again. And so, like it says in the big book right here, and I picked up this one thing. It says, this is on page 68. Perhaps there is a better way. We think so. This is the better way, by the way. That's why they say, perhaps there's a better way. You know, when you're around for a while, you know, it's possible. Unless until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences. And you may spend the first 10 years finding out what alcoholism is really about. You walk in here, and this is what you think. You think alcoholism has something to do, forget about some of you, you think it has to do with not drinking. That's what you think it is. You think, well, you know, it's like in the name, Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what I mean? Yeah, the book is called Alcoholics Anonymous. You can't be blamed for thinking it has something to do with drinking. They tell you, don't drink even if your ass falls off. They're handing out chips for not drinking. They're giving you medallions for not drinking. Everybody's talking about, I'm an alcoholic and I haven't had a drink. And you think, this is what you think, that alcoholism has something to do with drinking. And then you spend the next 40 years not drinking and working on your alcoholism. And every month, and every year, and every decade, your concept of what is alcoholism, how it affects you, what it really is that centers in your mind and your body, what you really suffer from it grows and grows, and you get a different vision of what alcoholic behavior is and what alcoholism isn't. You get a whole different vision of what sobriety is. You understand that just because you're merely physically sober, for some people, listen, with my sponsors, the guys who had 20, 30, 40 years, just because you weren't drinking didn't mean you were sober. Trust me, didn't mean you were sober at all. You know, when they say that man is sober, they mean then something more than just not drinking. And you may find yourself at 5 years sober looking at a guy who has 10 years, 20 years, 30 years sober and say, I want what he has and not even know what he has. But know, like Bill Dotson said in Alcoholics Anonymous 73, I knew there was something more, something I hadn't got. I used to follow men around the rooms like Ray O'Keefe, used to follow men's like Joe Snyder. I used to follow guys doing step series because I wanted what they had, and I thought, what they knew, like I'd learned the secret. The secret. And I learned, I didn't even know what the secret was, but I just figured if I hung out with them, if I went out to restaurants with them, it would slip one day. I'd hear something, you know? And the truth is, it's true. You start hanging out with them a lot. I mean, let me tell you something. To get what most people won't have ever in AA or in life, you have to be willing to sometimes do what most people won't do. You know, a lot of people will go to a meeting, arrive on time, and leave right away. Even less people will come early and stay late. Even less people will hang around with older members of Alcoholics Anonymous or get sponsors and stuff like that. I mean, there are people that are actually, you know, I was thinking the other day, it was interesting. I go to about 5 meetings a day. I mean, I'm able to do it now because of Zoom. I go to a 6 a.m. quiet time meeting where they basically just, there's about 40, 50 people on it. We read the Bible and different spiritual things and do some meditation. And then at 7 o'clock, I go to a meeting called the Serenity Meeting online. And then at 12 o'clock, I go to a men's meeting called Men on Track or Men Fully Alive, you know, where there's a bunch of men there, maybe sometimes as many as 100 men from all over the world. Maybe 25% of more than 30 or 40 years. I go to that meeting. And then at 4 o'clock, I go to my home group meeting, the South Dixie group, at 4 o'clock every day. And then at nighttime, like tonight, I mean, if I'm doing a meeting, I'm usually doing something. I'll go to another. I could go to 5 meetings like that. And so people will say to me, will say when they learn this, wow, that's a lot of meetings. That's a lot of meetings. I said, well, it's not for me. I mean, I managed to hold down. I'm a lawyer. I have a law office. I have 4 children, 7 grandchildren. I got a wife of 40 years. I mean, to me, it's like nothing. It's like we're rolling off a log. I used to spend 6 hours on a golf course. I would walk into a bar at 4:30 in the afternoon, and I would leave at 3 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning. I could do that. And I would see guys leave. I would see guys leave after an hour, and I'd say, where are they going? The booze and the broads are in here. Why are they leaving? I could drink 10 hours straight in a bar like it was nothing. You know what I mean? And I see people or party or run around and all that sort of stuff. And people think I'm crazy because I go to 5 meetings. And you know what I was thinking the other day? I just thought about this. It was amazing. And I say things like, well, on Zoom, it's easy to do. I was doing that when I had 2 years. I was doing that before Zoom, before anything. I would wake up in the morning. I'd drive to the car room. I'd go to a 7:30 meeting from 7:30 to 8:30. At 12 o'clock, when I was in downtown Miami, I'd go to a 12 o'clock meeting. On the way home, driving home, instead of going to the bar, I would go to a 5:30 meeting. And then at night, I knew my sponsor at an 8:30 meeting. I haven't counted them up. What is that, 4 meetings? I used to go to 4 meetings a day for years without even thinking of it because I had a way of life which demanded rigorous honesty. Because I was involved in the maintenance and growth of my life. Does that mean you don't have to do anything? I'm not telling you to do anything. I'm just telling you what I used to do. Okay? Maybe you can do it in an easier, softer way. Do it the way you want to do it. However you want to do it, you know, and see whether it works for you. So here's what this book says. It says, perhaps there is a better way. We think so. You know, one of the consequences of my alcoholism is sometimes I will read something and I won't see it. You know, there's a great line from the Oxford group. It says, a man can see something 999 times and see it the 1,000th time and see it for the first time. When you get involved in this thing, you'll find yourself a 10-year sobriety reading the line of the big book that you've read 10,000 times, and all of a sudden it means something to you. You say, man, that's the answer. Because there'll be stuff going on in your life where that is the answer. And so here's the deal. So perhaps there is a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. By the way, that's the theme throughout the book. That's why at the other end of the book, it says, once we sincerely make this decision for God, because we got to get rid of selfishness or it kills us, God makes that possible. Once we make a decision for God, all sorts of remarkable things happen. Being all powerful, he gives us everything we need if we stay close to him and perform his work well. But we may not know you. We cannot be sure of that because your real reliance has to be on God. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. The whole book is about having you find a power greater than yourself, which they call God, which will solve your problem, a faith that works. Perhaps there's a better way. We think so, for we're now on a different base, the base of trusting, relying upon God. We trust the infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us, and humbly rely on him does he enable us to match calamity with serenity. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our creator. I got it means when people apologize for talking about God. They feel guilty for talking about God. Because other people at meetings tell them they should feel guilty to talk about God. They tell them, don't talk about God. You'll scare away the newcomer. You'll scare away this guy. They tell them stuff like that. Let me tell you something. I love this fellowship, but let me explain to you about this fellowship. This ain't Well People's Anonymous. You'll hear as much bad shit here as you'll feel good, so you'll hear good shit. You better be careful about who you're listening to that is telling you stuff that is completely opposite of the book. There are people that will tell you religion is bad. I'm spiritual, not religious. They sort of like act as if they are better than all religious people because they don't have to go to the church or anything like that, and because it's stupid and they're just spiritual. Let me tell you something. I'm not spiritual. I'm evil and I'm material and left to my own device. I'm looking at the blonde. You know what I mean? That's it. I'm an alcoholic. I don't know what kind of disease. I don't know what kind of dis-ease you have. Maybe you have the disease where you don't lust after things. You're not addicted to other things. You don't wish you had more things. You don't get up in the morning and say, if I only had this. Maybe you have that kind of disease where it has nothing to do with the worldly climates like Bill Wilson has. That's not my disease, okay? I have a dis-ease. I'm not spiritual. I'm religious. I'm religious and spiritual. Who says that? I have a book that says we lose all prejudice, even against organized religion. We begin to see where these people are right, and we see where they're right, and we adopt them. What am I supposed to do with a guy who wants to tell me how much religion is stupid? When the book says opposite. What am I supposed to do with something like that in AA when I hear that all the time from people, and the book says on two different places we encourage church membership. Mm-hmm. And they encourage church membership because they all went to church. They said, most of us do that because we want to get closer to God. I mean, I don't know, where do you go to get closer to God? You're the Playboy Club? I mean, where do you go? You know, I'm not in an AA coffin, 10 years sober. You know, I was going to all the meetings. I was doing everything you could do. I was sponsoring hundreds. I was going crazy. Intergroup banquet chairman 2 years in a row, the whole bit. And you know something? I wasn't happy with my sobriety. You know why? Because it was getting stale. Because I wasn't growing. I was going to meetings, hearing the same old stuff, the same old stuff. Some guy tapped me on the shoulder. He says, why don't you do this? He suggested I go to Bible study. I said, I'm not going there. You know why I wasn't going there? Because AA said it was bad. I don't know where I got that from. It's complete opposite of what they said to Dr. Bob, the good old timers. I started doing that. Everything changed for me. I'm not saying you have to do it. I'm just telling you what I did. It says, we never apologize to anyone for depending upon our creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality is the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it's the way of strength. The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. That's the second time they said that. You know why they said it a second time? Because they never apologized for God. Bill Wilson didn't apologize for God. Dr. Bob didn't apologize for God. Dr. Bob said, if you're an atheist or an agnostic, have some sort of intellectual pride that keeps you from understanding what we're saying in this book, I feel sorry for you. Your heavenly Father will never let you down. Most people in AA think that AA applaud atheism, think agnosticism is a good thing. It's fantastic. That's not the position of the AA program. I'm just telling you. You know, I'm sorry. You can have your own opinion. You can't have your own facts. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We let him demonstrate through us what he can do. We ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us be. At once, we commence to outgrow fear. How many people like to outgrow fear and not have anxiety? I mean, or maybe you just want to not drink and be waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning worrying about money. Or maybe you just want to not drink and worry about why you're alone or why you don't have a girlfriend or boyfriend or what's going to happen if this happens. Or maybe you just like waking up with all sorts of people in your head that you're worried about what they're thinking about you or what you got. Maybe you just like living a life of anxiety. I mean, how many people would like to be walking in the fourth dimension of existence and experience much of heaven? I mean, if you're going to be here for 10 or 15 years, you might as well go on the rocket ship ride, don't you think? That's what they're trying to tell you to do. What do you think? You just sit on your ass and you say, well, I'm spiritual, not religious. And you think your body really and your mind actually believes that shit? When you're worried, if you're so spiritual, why are you worried so much all the time? If you're so spiritual, why do you wake up worrying about stuff? Why are you always worried about what other people think about you? So, why are you scared to talk about aliens, about God or anything, if you're so spiritual? You know, I mean, I lived in a world before I came today where I was always looking at other people to see what they would like or what they'd like me or what they don't want. Why are you such an approval junkie? Why do you worry so much about what people think about you in AA? You know something? If you worry about what people think about you in AA, you're not sober. You're not sober. Does that piss you off? We'll talk to your sponsor about it, because whenever you're disturbed, right? Whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. So if you want to go out there and say, why did they invite that guy? He pissed me off. He doesn't know anything about the program and get pissed off. Well, thank you. If you want to drink over what I said, be my guest. Use me as an excuse. Maybe it'll get you to come in here and actually do something serious. You understand what I'm saying? Because I can tell you this, the people that believe in God, the people that are doing this stuff, the people that have been separated out, the men and the boys, you want something, they don't have a problem with anything I'm saying. The real deal, the genuine articles, they don't have a problem with anything I'm saying. What they're saying is just tell them like it is. They know exactly what's going on. The guys who are over 34, they know exactly what's going on. The other guys are saying, oh, you're being a little too harsh, you know, hurting alcoholics. After the film, it makes me a blast. The only things I'll be left on the planet are cockroaches and alcoholics. We get in cars dead drunk. We drive our car into a family of four. They all die. We walk away with a bruise. You can't hurt an alcoholic. Hurt an alcoholic's feelings. The only reason we're here in the first place is because our feelings got hurt. If our heels were hurt, we'd be out there raping, robbing, and doing whatever we do. The only reason anybody gets sober and does this stuff is because they're in the pain. And I'll tell you, if you want to know what an obnoxious alcoholic is, it's an alcoholic that hasn't had enough pain. And believe me, I deal with them all the time in my business. So the bottom line is why do our stories demonstrate what it used to be like, what happened, whatever we are like, our story, why are the stories and testimony important? Because if God is demonstrating in your life what this thing is all about, then the truth of the matter is, any story I tell you that has anything to do with my sobriety and how I act in my sobriety and what I have done, whether it be the Leo story, or the chicken on the roof story, because I'm a recovered alcoholic, will somehow demonstrate within the story every step. Because after you do this thing for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, you don't stay sober in mind and body unless your life illuminates the steps. And all you have to do is say, this is what happened to me today. This is the situation that happened, I don't care what the situation is. This is how I felt about it, and this is how I acted. And you will be telling everybody in the audience what sobriety is about, and somebody will hear step three, and somebody will hear step one, and somebody will hear step 12. And they'll hear whatever they're supposed to hear, because the only thing that you need to do a good AA meeting is to be sincere. As a friend of mine once said, once you learn how to fake that, you got it made. So what does it have to do? This have to do with the nice thing? So I made up my mind when I woke up this morning, I was going to actually talk about the step. And I have like 15 minutes left, so I'm going to do a little nine-step to prove to you that I have actually done it. And I know most of you think I've never done the steps before. You know, I just sort of got here by being good looking. I didn't like that chuckle. Okay. You know, I did a fourth step. You know, the eighth step comes from the fourth step. If you don't know, this is abbreviated. This is a fast-paced abbreviated thing. I did a fourth step. Now, you don't have to do it. You don't have to get mad at me. I'm not putting you down. The way I did it is by the book. I opened up this book. Listen, there's a chart in there. You know, this is the way I figure it with everybody I sponsor. Why don't you try it the way they outlined it in the fourth step, and then you can do the Hazleton 18,000 step thing or whatever they do. I'm not putting that down, but I said, we got a whole thing in this book, and somebody's attached, and it has a chart where it has a list, list number one. I resent my cousin, what's-her-face. Why? Because she's a rich bitch, you know, and she's never had any problems, and she always thinks she's better than everybody else. What does this affect? My self-esteem, my personal relationship. We have a chart there. If you're an alcoholic and you don't resent, if you're brand new, you're an alcoholic and you're not pissed off at least 10 people, there's something wrong. You know what I mean? You know, I just put down all my bitches. And then the next thing it says, disregarding all that crap and what they did to you, where were you at fault? And then write down what I'm at fault. You know, maybe it's just I gossip about it. Maybe it's just that everybody I talk to, I say, you know, my cousin, so-and-so, she's such a rich bitch. Maybe I just character assassinate her. Who knows what I do? And then they have a list of fears. You know what I mean? You know the fears, you know. Fear of being broke, fear of people laughing at you, fear of being humiliated, fear of being alone, all that crap. You know, put that down there. Then a list of things having to do with sexual deals as far as where you've hurt somebody or where you've been, you put the list down. I'm not going to list that's a four-step stuff. The eighth step comes out of the fourth step. But it's not necessarily totally the fourth, because in the fourth step, and after you do the fifth step, because your sponsor, whoever it is you do the fifth step with, they may enlighten you as to, they may tell you that there are actually things that should be on the list, people that you've hurt, that maybe, you know, maybe you should be thinking about, you know, so after you go through the fourth and fifth step, then you have a good basis to know who should be on the eighth step list. And the eighth step list, it's not necessarily people you have resentment against. I had my son, my young son. I got divorced when he was 5 years old. Then I left the house. And I didn't have resentment against him, but he was on my A-step list. One Saturday, I was supposed to pick him up and take him to the zoo. I told him I was going to take him to the zoo. He said, you're going to take him to the zoo, Zach? I said, absolutely. And I really intended to take him to the zoo. I swear I intended to take him to the zoo. You ever intend really to do something right, and then for some reason you don't do it? And then you say, I really wanted to do it, you know, but you don't show up. And that morning at 10 o'clock, he was waiting for his daddy, and I got a call from Sally. Well, Sally, the guy was taking up the night before, and she said, Russell, me and the gals are going out on the boat. Would you like to come along? Oh, man, it started me thinking. And I was as sober as I am right now. I don't blame alcohol on being an asshole or irresponsible. I'm thinking. Picking up my son and going to the zoo, or Sally on the boat, Sally with the booze, Sally with the girls, Sally with the sex. Oh, it was an incredible struggle. But after about 10 seconds, it was anchors. Sure, you're laughing. You don't know what it was like. You know what I mean? And I didn't even call him up. Stop that. I don't need that crap from you. You know what I mean? Oh, what a monster. Well, you know why I did that? And you know something? You live a life like that? Trust me, you're going to drink. Trust me, you're going to drink. Because deep down inside, there's like a little portion of Darren Gray. You know what you're doing. There's a real, and you're saying to yourself, he'd be better with his mother. He wouldn't like it. You're telling yourself all this bullshit because I'm a rationalizer. I tell myself rational lies because what it says in the book, I'm delusional. I can't separate the truth from the false. My alcoholic dishonest life seems the only normal life. And deep down inside, deep down where I live, where I have a constitutional ability to be honest with myself and say, you are one piece of shit. Because you know who lives their lives like that? Irresponsible people live their lives like that. Monsters live their lives like that. Crappy people live their lives. And I was a crappy person. I was a selfish, crappy person. It wasn't an alcohol problem. It was being a crappy person, a selfish person problem. And I continued like that for 5 or 6 or 10 years. When I was sober, like 3 or 4 years, my son wrote me a letter. He said, you've been the worst dad I never. And I was sober for many years. And I was taking him out. He said, I didn't want to, not all sorts of things. And my wife, okay, then said, well, you ought to cut him off. And God told me, he says, no, I'm going to tell him every time I speak to him, anything happens, I'm just going to write him. I'm going to tell him how much I love him. That's all I'm going to do. I'm just going to tell him how much I love him. And I did that for about 5 or 6 years. Every chance I get, I said, I love you. I love you. I love you. How you doing? I love you. I just want my wife and my daughters, his sisters were offended, you know, the way I said, no. They were all saying to me, you want to cut him? I said, no, I'm just going to tell him I love him. And now he's got two great grandkids he gave me and a wonderful wife. And I'm visiting them in about a few months. And he's going to come down and visit me. And we have a great relationship. You know, because I didn't give in to, I'll show him who the hell he thinks he is. So my brother. So when I was growing up, the one person I think I was closest to was my grandmother on my mother's side, Nana Ethel. Ethel, she was an interesting character. You know, I lived with them. I had to leave my house. I couldn't, because my mother was an alcoholic. I couldn't live there anymore. And I had to leave my house. And so for a couple of years, I lived with my Nana Ethel. And I was one crazy son of a bitch kid. I'm telling you, I'm up on Miami Beach almost every night with my buddies, looking the score, running around, trying to find the ladies, doing all that crap and everything. I waltz in at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. They're in like their 60s. They didn't need that crap. And I would always, you know, something, and they'd say, she'd say things, you know, Russell, you're basically a good boy, which I'm not sure what that means. I'm not sure it's a compliment, okay? It's sort of like deep, deep, deep down inside, there's probably something good about you. I don't know. But you know something about my, and you know, I'll tell you something about Nana. I would see her. I would get up in the morning, she'd be there chain smoking cigarettes, talking about, oh, your Uncle Jerry, I'm worried about your Uncle Jerry. Oh, this one, I'm worried about this. I'm like, her whole life was worried about the family, worried about everybody else. Maybe she was codependent. I don't know what that was going on, but her whole life was taking care of other people and worried about other people. That was it. But you know something? Whenever Grandma, can I borrow 20 bucks? Sure. She always says 20 bucks. Can I have 40? Sure. I need money for this? Sure. She never said no. She never chastised me. She always showed me love, and she always gave me the 20 bucks. My grandma died the night I did my fourth step. The night I did my fourth step, I came home from a meeting, and my wife kept me and says, your grandmother passed away, unexpectedly. I didn't have a chance to do a nice step, an amends with my grandmother. I just didn't have a chance. She passed away. So I have a brother. And he's the youngest brother. I'm the oldest brother. I'm the guy who was graduated with Department of Honors in Mathematics. I went to law school. I became a division chief. My younger brother was the one who was left with my mother when she went through her worst alcoholism at the house. He's the one who had to go be hospitalized in a mental institution because the crap that he had to deal with. He was the one with dyslexia. He was the one who wasn't me. He was the opposite of me. And so my youngest brother called me up one day, and I had about 3 or 4 years sober, sobriety, after my grandmother died. And he said, and it was, you know, at night, it was like at 7 o'clock at night, and I'm sort of lying down on the couch. And he said, Russell, can I come over? I said, well, what is it? What is it? I'm not going to use his name. He's actually in the fellowship for 32 years, 32, 33 years, you know, in NA. I said, well, what is it? What do you want? I knew what he wanted. He only called me up for one thing, money. And he said, well, you know, I'm a little bit short of the rent. And I said, so that's why you called me up at 7 o'clock at night, because you need money for rent? He says, yeah, I really need money. I said, it's that important. So when do you need it? Well, if you give it, so you need it right now. In other words, you got to come over to my house right now at 7 o'clock at night to get money. You need it right now. Is that it? He says, yeah, I need it right now. I need it now. I wouldn't call you if it wasn't an emergency. I said, okay, come on over. What the hell? Come on over. And I was like mad and angry because he called me up late at night. He was running over. He needed money. And I was sick and tired of giving him money and all this sort of stuff. And the bottom line is, and I think that part of my thinking was, get this, part of my thinking, because I'm an alcoholic, was if I mean enough and if I hurt him enough, maybe he'll never ask me for money again. I know that was part of the thinking, you know, just beat the shit out of him, you know. So I laid back down on the couch waiting for him. And what do you think happened? I started thinking about my grandmother. She always used to give me money. She never used to yell at me. She never made me feel bad. And all she did was worry about the family and how everybody was doing the family. And I started thinking, what would my grandmother do if my brother called him up and asked him for $20 or $40, she'd give him the money. And I didn't have a chance to make amends to my grandmother. So by the time my brother showed up, and he came in, he was sort of cowering, you know what I mean? I said, hey, come on in. Here's the money you need. He says, do you need any? And then I said, believe it or not, this is the truth. I said, you need any more? You need anything more? I mean, I was overcome by the spirit, you know? If that doesn't happen, don't anybody come up and ask me for money. Don't get ahead of me here, you know? I said, you need any more? And he, like, how he was scared. He said, no, I don't need any more, you know? And I've been taking care of my brother for a long time. Myself and my other brother take care of my brother. And I got to be honest with you. To me, it's an amends to my grandmother. I didn't do that because of me. I'm still a selfish son of a bitch. To me, that's a ninth step amends. That's a direct amends to my grandmother who passed away, you know, a couple years before that. That's an amends to my grandmother. And I have a lot of stories. I mean, I honestly, I swear, I actually did the steps. I'm still doing them, but I probably don't realize them most of the time because I've been doing them so long. So like, it's like an automatic thing. You know, these days, you know, whenever I get disturbed, if that happens, it doesn't happen that often, but all of a while it happens, you know, for a nanosecond, I get disturbed and then I say, what the hell's wrong with me? Why is this bothering me? I figure it out. If it gets real bad, I write it down. Otherwise, I pretty much know what it is. I know what the story is. I need to talk to somebody about it. Talk about something. I don't like being disturbed. I don't like living with the ghosts in my head of my child waiting for me at the window when I don't show up. I don't like living with guilt. I no longer have to worry about running into anybody. I don't have to check my phone ID to see who's calling me. I don't even accept the spam calls. You know what I mean? I hang up on them. You know what I mean? But you never know. I don't want to, you know, I mean, I don't have to, I don't live a life where I see somebody and I turn around and say, man, I hope he doesn't see me. And walk out the door. I don't have to live a life of guilt anymore. I lived that life for many years. Do you know what it's like to live a life where you actually worry about what are you going to say if you run into somebody? Man, that's I can't even explain to you what kind of shitty life that is when you live a life worrying about whether somebody's going to call you or what you're going to say to them. And that's the life I lived for many, many years before coming to AA. And for a few years after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it's terrible living with guilt. It's a terrible deal. So you see, does that qualify as a ninth? Did I do a little ninth? Was there a little ninth step in there?
There was a few others.
There was a few others? Okay. So thank you very much. God bless.